9 o'clock, so let us begin. We are continuing with Eliezer Berkovitz. We'll have two more classes with him. We're going to be moving on this semester to look at Rabbi Chaim Moser Grzynski, a very important person. We have 10 classes scheduled this semester, although I will be in Israel, hopefully, for one of them, so it'll really only be 9 classes. Then we're going to move to Rev Elijah Eliyahu Ben Amozig, back to Italy, from where we were with Rabbi Yisrael Moshe Chazan, and assume we have time this semester to return again to Morocco with Rabbi Yosef Messas. All fascinating people, a lot to say. Now, in the time, it's been a while since we've been together. Excited to be back. Many of you sent me questions or comments. I'd like to get to some of them, obviously not all of them. And for those who are new, for about the first 10 minutes of each class, if there's questions or comments, I take the time to respond to them. So let me begin responding. One of you wants to know if I have read, and if so, can I, since it's a class on great Torah scholars, that's what we're doing here, if I can say a word or two about this book that came out. You can get it now in New York. It's unusual. It's a biography of a living sage, which you don't expect that, and it's a biography of Rav Yosef Shalom Alyoshev, turned 100 years old about a month ago, the leader of the Lithuanian Yeshiva world. I have the book. I read it over Pesach. So let me just say a few words about this. I guess eventually we'll have a session on Rav Yosef. This is a very interesting, yes, but very unusual book. It proves the point I've said over and over again about how the ethos in the Haredi world is so much different than what we think. I think most of us listening to us and even think is normal. And I'm going to read you some things here which are stated as praise and as things to be admired, and I am certain that everyone listening, no matter what community you're from, will find it shocking. And I have to be honest, and I spoke to a number of people about this book. I don't know anyone who read this book and whose opinion of the man, Rav Yosef, the great Torah sage, has been raised. On the contrary, anyone who's read this book that I've spoken to has come away with it really with a negative opinion, feeling very sorry for this man. All his greatness, let me explain to you what I'm talking about. I was hoping that I would be disabused of certain notions. His reputation for 60 years has been a very stern person, a very dour person, and that is actually heated and distressed in this book. There's one picture of him with a smile. Unlike Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who it's all smiles. It's been known by everyone that he is not a people person and doesn't get along with people. And again, I thought that reading the book, you'd get a sense that that's really just the impression, but it's not true. And on the contrary, the book stresses that he's not a people person, although the book does try to say that the reason is he's very shy, he never was comfortable being around people. This isn't unusual, I think. Sometimes people who are great geniuses are more comfortable with the books than with other people. There's no question you don't come away from this as thinking of him as a tzaddik in the sense, obviously he's a tzaddik in the sense that he observes Torah and mitzvos, but when you think of a tzaddik like the Chafetz Chaim or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, people who do things for other people who are doing chesed, things like that, the book is very clear that he doesn't do chesed. His whole life is spent in learning, and that therefore the only chesed he can do is to answer shilas, answer questions. To answer questions. Now, let me just read you a few passages to show you what I'm talking about here, which to me I find quite shocking. And what's most shocking is that even the people who wrote this book, it's written anonymously, and there was some controversy because some people were opposed to it, but he apparently also has the support of members of Rav Yosef's family. He quotes from them in the book. Even the author would tell you that the sort of thing I'm going to read you now, which might remind you of some of the Brisker stories, is not something that other people should try to do, or it's not something that is for the average person. But the fact that they're included in a book like this leads people to think that this is something to be admired. Maybe I could strive for this. And I happen to see it as just completely dysfunctional. The book, for example, describes him as having no relationship whatsoever with his children. And that here we're describing the greatest sage, and as part of his greatness is that he has absolutely no relationship with his children. And if I was writing a hagiography, I would cover that up. Let me give you an example. This comes from page 62, quoting his daughter. Abba lo haya mafrin banu bishmotenu. Our father did not really distinguish between us by our names. He couldn't identify us. It describes how he didn't have any time to play with his children. And even if he knew their names, it was a sign that he wasn't involved with them. Okay, so perhaps it's a bit of an exaggeration. That's what's being described. It talks about how only Motzei Shabbos, right before Motzei Shabbos ended, he'd go for a walk. And that's the only time in the week that he ever had a chance to talk to the children or have anything to do with them. The whole point of the book is the stress that he always would be learning, incredible learning, day and night, in this Beis Medrash, constantly. No relationship with his family, no relationship with his children. Sichot l'shem sicha v'diburim yoladav o'ima ima af pam lo hayu. He never once had just simple conversations with his children or with his wife. If you look at the biographies of Rishon Zalman Auerbach, it's just the opposite. It's about a person who loved to converse, who made everyone feel like they were special when he spoke to them. Kal v'chomer, he had no talk, he doesn't talk to anyone else, but he didn't even talk to his wife or his children. When something was needed, he would say what to do. But alechet im rabbanit le'ez makom, to go on a tiyul, to go with his wife any place, this is impossible, it says. He didn't have time for this. It says that he would speak to the sons sometimes in learning to see what they're learning, but with the daughters, lo hayu lo diburim im habanot, he would not speak to the daughters. This is how they grew up. And then he quotes one of the daughters describing this. Zo hamatziyut shel habayit, this is what the house was like. Lo medabrin im abba, v'lo mafrim et halimud. You don't talk to your father. You don't disturb him. And it describes in detail here how all he would do is learn. Have literally no role. Now, can this be something good? This, to me, doesn't seem like something that we should even talk about. I think if we have a great sage who, unfortunately, has no people skills and can't relate to people, even can't relate to his own family, this isn't something that we should be talking about in a book. This is something that certainly hagiography should be covering up, because this is not something that people should look at and say this is a sign of greatness. Or k'shehim ba'im etzol b'bikurim, ein lahem sicha m'tushefet bichal. When the children come to visit, they come to visit the mother. They have no relationship whatsoever with the father. And look, I don't need to belabor the point here. That's a theme in this book, how he was able to overcome all emotions. It talks about when his daughter dies. This is page 244. 244 is a story where he gets angry at someone because 1 minute of his day is wasted. The driver was a little late. I mean, if you Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, it'll be a completely different story. But on have a story here, which is just like the story that Rav Soloveitchik tells about his grandfather. And when his daughter was dying, it's on page 251. When they came to tell him that his daughter died, what did he do? He was learning Choshen Mishpat. He got up and he put in the volume of Choshen Mishpat and took out the one of Yoredeya so he could learn the Halachos of Avelos. I find these type of stories, I can't imagine how anyone sees this as something to aspire to, but yet this is printed and advertised as a form of hagiography. They can never translate this book into art scroll, because Americans, even American Haredim, would be shocked, and really I think they would feel very sad to see a case where a father literally has no relationship with his children and no desire to have any relationship with his children, because learning is all that matters to him. I don't think you can say that this comes from learning. This comes from a personality who, as the book says, is very uncomfortable around people. But then you might find people who read this and say, well, I too am going to be a Gadol Yisrael, and I can't have any relationships with my wife or my family. So anyone who's interested in reading a very strange Gadolim book, this is the one. I don't know if so similar to the Gra as much as the stories that Rav Soloveitchik tells about how his grandfather, not Rav Chaim. Rav Chaim used to get on his hands and knees and the children would jump on his back. But his other grandfather, Rav Elia Pruzhiner, he said his daughter was near death and he was wearing his tefillin and he says, tell me when she's about to die, I'll take my tefillin off and go into her. And you do have some brisker stories like the brisker Rav. Belvila, when one of his children died before the child was 30, his wife and the other members of the family were crying, were sad, and he screamed at them. We're told in the book that before a child is 30 days old, it doesn't have the status of a child that of a life, like you do normal avelos. Therefore, stop crying. You have these sorts of stories, but. I would think that today, to tell stories about how a father is so removed from his children and has literally no relationship, how could that be a Torah value? Even if you say it's for the exceptional people, that this is the way to live, how can even someone say that this is for the exceptional people? If I was doing a hagiography, these are precisely the sorts of stories that show weakness, and we all have weaknesses, obviously. But these are not the sort of stories I would put in a book because I don't think that this leads people to admiration. On the contrary, and there's numerous other stories like this. Unfortunately, I think it did a terrible disservice to his reputation because this was the reputation. And to see it even tripled and quadrupled because we're dealing with personal stories has just permanently, put into people's minds that you're dealing with a very different type of gadol than Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, etc., etc. I find it really very sad and disappointing. Do we know about Rav Elia? We know about Rav Elia's daughter, and we're told stories about Rav Elia, but the story itself is just so out of character and so strange. Now, what you said about the Gra, it is true. He went to the woods, and he was so involved in learning, he forgot about a sick child. So you have a story like that. But this is a story being told 200 years ago, and it's a completely different environment. To tell stories like this in the 21st century, and whoever says that this is a value, not to have relationships with your children because you're learning all the time, and everyone I've spoken to who's read the book has come away with the same thing, that this is sick. This is not normal. This is not Torah values, and that's a terrible disservice. And this might be the reason why certain people in the family protested the book, precisely because these are the sorts of things that should not be made public. These are not things to be proud of, but that's their grandfather, though. He's not a people person. But other members of the family apparently think this is just fine. Yes, Rav Yosef and his daughter, I haven't heard of, that's the daughter I'm assuming who opened up the school. It's a very different situation. Rav Yosef is very much a people person. He's always been a people person. The real biography needs to be written, how Rav Yosef, who wasn't a people person, was able to assume this position of authority. Rav Shach was also a people person. He could be very friendly and was a real raconteur. And Rav Yosef is, I can't think of any other Gadolim who really wanted no human relationships and just their whole life just wanted to stay in a base medrash. He had to be brought out, and he was made into this figure. He never speaks publicly. He gives a shiur. That's it. We will get to Rav Yosef. There's a lot to be said, obviously, about him. And it's a fascinating story, going from the Rabbanut to the leader of the Lithuanian yeshiva world. There's a lot to say. We'll return. Chaim, it's a good question. I would think it does. He has one story in there. There, Svi Weinman, who's one of the people who made Rav Yosef famous. He's a Tohen Rabbani. He was involved in terrible cases of divorce and other things, and Rav Yosef tells him, let me read you what Rav Yosef tells him. And it might be good advice. Because, look, some of you are lawyers. You know, you can't get so involved personally with all your cases. It'll destroy you. But I don't know. This is what Rav Yashiv tells him. He's having a hard time with affecting him personally. And Rav Yashiv says to him these words, Al tikach alev. Shum davar shelo yeh nogeh elecha. Anything that doesn't affect you personally, don't let it affect you. Act like me. And then he says he touched the elevator button. In other words, these things don't bother me. It's as if like I'm touching a button. I'm not elevator button. Touch his button. It is, these things are meaningless. Don't let anything that you're involved with affect you. You know, it might be good advice for people who are involved in terrible things. These people who work in the UN, you know, if every one of these terrible cases of children dying would affect them, they never would be able to continue the work. But on the other hand, Dayan has numerous sources that say a Dayan is supposed to be empathetic and pain. And Rav Yashiv is saying that you are not supposed to have any emotional connection to it at all. It's all just an actual thing. It's, like I said, we need to do some more investigation. Now, there are some psukim where you see this, I have to say. There's one in particular that I've never made public, and I won't make public, because I think it, and I know Rabbi Bleich says he wouldn't write about it because it would bring disrepute on Judaism. It's about how to treat people with AIDS. If we deal with Rabbi Yashiv, I'll deal with it. But I just want to call your attention to this book, if any are interested. I have other things to say, but it's time to move on to Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. We ended last class, if you recall. I mentioned that there was a Berkowitz conference in Chicago that I spoke, and today Hebrew Theological College wouldn't even allow him to speak. I also made some comments about the synagogue, the old synagogue of Rabbi Rachman, Shari Tefillah, and someone pointed out that it could be that I'm mistaken, that they would allow people to speak, although they haven't yet. If you look at their list of speakers, they wouldn't. That was Wurzberger and Rachman's old show. I was talking about how institutions change, and Berkowitz was the leading figure at Skokie, and today he wouldn't be allowed in the place. And let me tell you about a famous event that happened, which is very different, obviously, today, because the institution stood by Berkowitz. This happened in 1964. There was a banquet. I think it was Purim, if I'm not mistaken, although it might have been Hanukkah. I can't recall. And Rav Chaim Zimmerman, if you recall, Rav Chaim Zimmerman, who was the Rosh Yeshiva, first it was Rabbi Feisworth for a few years, and then was Chaim Zimmerman, the genius of geniuses, so we spoke about him, how unconventional he was. He is speaking, and at the dais, you have the other Rabbanim, and you have Eliezer Berkowitz, and in his talk, Zimmerman refers to Eliezer Berkowitz as a heretic, as an apikoros. I mean, whether he thought he was joking he certainly thought Berkowitz was an apikoros, but whether he thought he could make a joke about it, I don't know. Berkowitz, however, becomes so angry that he picks up a plate and throws it, and smashes into a million pieces. And those of you from Chicago, you can speak to Rabbi Sam Biber. He was there at the time, as were others. Sam actually picked up the pieces, and they could tell you about this. Well, as you can imagine, created an enormous controversy, not just in the yeshiva, but in town. Two obviously weren't going to be speaking anymore, and the whole yeshiva was thrown into some sort of conundrum, what to do about this situation, and the administration decided to fire Rav Chaim Zimmerman. Next day they fired him for publicly insulting Eliezer Berkowitz. Was anyone drunk? It's a good question. I'm not sure if it was Purim, though. I'll need to go back and check the records. And by the way, that's what allows Rav Aaron Soloveitchik to eventually come into Skokie, because it wasn't immediately, but he's allowed to come in because now that Zimmerman's gone, he can come in. And later, Aaron Soloveitchik would have his own problems with Skokie. And he also was forced to leave, or decided himself he has to leave. I think different versions of the story. He didn't want to leave, but they sort of forced him out. But he started holding shiur on the law, and it was another big controversy. They haven't had such good luck with the Rosh Yeshiva in Chicago. But what was the issue Chaim Zimmerman had with Berkowitz? The issue was what everyone had. It wasn't with his theology that we'll discuss a little later. It was his view of the halachic process that created controversy. tied into this was his refusal to be bound by the people he regarded as the Gedolim. He had a great sense of confidence and didn't feel bound by the people we call today call Gedolim. I read you some of his private letters last semester. Someone told me, it was in Skokie, that he mentioned something that Rav Moshe Feinstein said to Berkovitz, and he referred to him as one of the Gedolim. And Berkovitz replied, well, if he's one of the Gedolim, then I'm a Gedol also. He thought he had a tremendous sense of self-confidence. He recognized his own knowledge, and he wasn't about to fall into line behind these other figures. People were saying that he had, Berkovitz, you have to listen to what the Gedolim say. And his attitude was, well, if they're Gedolim, why shouldn't I be a Gedol? Very similar to Nussan Kamenetsky. When the ban came out about him, the only one who took seriously as having signed the ban was Rav Elyashiv. And then when the American Rosh Yeshiva signed the ban, oh yeah, the Rosh Yeshiva from Berlin and Lakewood, Rav Nussan Kamenetsky's response was, if these people are Gedolim, then I'm a Gedol. I'm the same age as them. I'm colleagues with them. Why should their opinion outweigh me? And that was Berkovitz's thought. Now, Berkovitz published a number of articles on halacha. He even has some stuff which hasn't been published. In the last issue of the Chovei Torah Journal, Milin Chavivin, you can get it online right now. I published for the first time Eliezer Berkovitz's tshuva about going into a church. Very relevant because of the Lookstein episode. And it's also relevant today because Chief Rabbi of Poland, Michael Shuldrish, he attended the funeral last week. President of Poland, who was killed in the plane crash, and this was in a church, and one of the Haredi newspapers splashed his picture all on the front there as this heretic Sheldrach is going into a church. It had a picture of him with the priests in the church, and Sheldrach claims that he had a psak from a Rav, a posek in Eretz Yisrael, permitting him, and he's had done interesting things like this before. I think, if I'm not mistaken, he turns to Rav Sharyashev Cohen, or maybe Rav Zalman Nechemia Goldberg. This is not the first case. Emanuel Jacobovitz, with the approval of his Beis Din, would go to churches and even to various ceremonies. The Lockerbie disaster was in a church. Jacobovitz went there. So the idea that Eva or Shalom Malchus, or however you want to put it, the president of Poland was a great friend of the Jews. There's no question that you can find a heter for something like this, not for the average person, but for the official representative of the Jewish community who was asked by the government to attend the service. He was able to get a heter for that from a reliable posek. Berkovitz, however, he argues in this response that I invite all of you to look at, that simply, and he did not like Christianity at all, as we'll see. In fact, he hated Christianity, unfairly so, I think. But he argues that if you're just going in to look at the artwork or anything like that, it's permissible halachically. And one of my friends suggested perhaps it's because he hated Christianity so much and the idea that anyone really could find something attractive in Christian theology, maybe that's what led him to think that this is just a question of art. It's just, as we would say, Daud Amos, so just going in to see the artwork. In terms of his halachic writings, he published, first of all, spoke about his book on marriage and divorce. He published a book in Hebrew on Jewish law. He published a version in English, Not in Heaven, Nature and Function of Halacha. And let me summarize what he has to say in this book. First, before getting into that, right at the end of the preface, page 2, I read this to you last semester, he says that, although I am taking my stand on the foundations of halachic Judaism, as it was handed down to me in my father's house, and I acquired it in my studies in yeshivos and from my teacher, Rabbi Weinberg. He then goes on to say, I am guided in this book exclusively by the halachic material, not by my teachers. He's trying to tell you that this work is not something he had from his teachers. He has knowledge from his teachers, and he develops it on his own. He recognizes that this is going to be a bit controversial. He understands that if they want to attack, let them attack him. He begins by speaking of the importance of svara, of logic, in the halachic system. And he shows how the rabbis use common sense for understanding to explain halacha. Anyone who's learned Gemara, knows that the notion of svara, some people think it even has the status of a biblical commandment, or a raisa, But svara is very important. Things need to make sense. And he gives an example. According to halacha, biblical halacha, at least the rabbis derive it, you can't wash on Yom Kippur. You all know that's one of the five things we don't do, wash on Yom Kippur. Yet the rabbis said that a bride can wash within 3 days of her marriage so that she can appear nice to her husband. How do the rabbis have the authority? The Torah says you can't wash. What gives them the authority to say that a bride can wash? For Berkovitz, this isn't a question of the rabbis altering halacha, or, as the conservatives would say, bringing their humane insights to touch up the halacha, or bring it to make it easier to follow, anything like that. Not at all. It's simply an example of the rabbis using their wisdom to clarify the halacha. The rabbis don't think that this law was ever intended to apply to such a case. It's not that the rabbis are conscious reformers, then who realize that it's forbidden to wash and say, well, we're going to make an exception. No. They are using their svara to reveal what the Talmud's what the Torah's parameters are in this matter. They're the ones that determined that this is one of the restrictions, and it's incomprehensible to them that the Torah would have included among the parameters a bride. Just like if it's incomprehensible that if your hands are dirty, you know, it's only rechitza shel tanug, a washing for enjoyment. Technically, washing not for enjoyment is permissible, but we avoid all washing. Now, if you look in the Shulchan Aruch, it's in Aruch Hayim 613, says that a bride can wash her face. That's the halacha. Yet, if you look at the Mishnah Berurah, cites the Chayei Adam. The Chayei Adam says that since today, husbands and wives don't see each other in Yom Kippur, it appears to me, the Chayei Adam says, and the Mishnah Berurah adopts this, that it's no longer permitted. And the Chayei Adam says that he has not heard that anyone is accustomed to follow this heter. It used to, I don't know, in our communities, I don't know, do any brides, if you ask a rabbi a question, I don't know what they'll tell you. It used to be, this is the theory of the Chayei Adam, adopted by the Mishnah Berurah, people didn't stay in shul the whole day like we do. If you look at the high holiday liturgy in the Rambam, it's very quick. We'd be out of shul very fast. Next time you're in Yom Kippur and Rosh Hashanah, look at all the piyuti, the other things that have been added, the prayers, they're medieval prayers. So in the non-Ashkenazic lands, it would be much quicker. However, today, that we're in shul the whole day, it's not like the bride and the groom are going to be hanging out together. There's no need this heter. Yet, if you look at our community, the fact is that in our community, I don't know what it was like in Vilna. Maybe in Vilna they were in shul literally the whole day, but in our communities we're not in shul the whole day. In our communities we have a break, 2 hours, 3 hours, whatever it is. So the heter should still be applicable. And if you look in the Aruch HaShulchan, this is halacha. The Aruch HaShulchan is writing the same time as the Mishnah Berurah, the early 20th century, and late 19th century, perhaps, in that section. The Aruch HaShulchan says that a bride could wash her face, and he doesn't say anything about not being applicable. And he says the reason. The reason is the bride is not washing her face for employment. She's washing her face to appear for her husband. I really wonder what a posek, not the local community rabbi who is in the Mishnah Berurah and tell you the halacha, or happened to open the Aruch HaShulchan, but if you ask a posek, one who actually, today people, most people don't paskin. The typical rav just tells you what the Mishnah Berurah says. But if you ask a real posek, I wonder what they would say today. Can a bride, do we follow the Mishnah Berurah or do we follow the Aruch HaShulchan? And especially since in our communities we're not in shul all day, it would appear that the logic behind the Chayei Adam's position, followed by the Mishnah Berurah, doesn't apply. The Kitzur Shulchan Aruch, by the way, the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch is usually so extreme, full of chumras on top of chumras. He's Hungarian. He actually quotes the Chayei Adam and says, "Ein devar of muchrachin." He says the Chayei Adam is wrong, that the heter still does apply. So, if anyone can find an answer to that, let me know. Now, throughout this book, rabbis are seen as active participants in creating the halacha. You understand that's the case in the days of the Pharisees, the days of the rabbis. Going to give you examples even after that. And he gives many examples, though, of Chazal, the early rabbis, how they, I think we would call it maybe halachic innovations that originate in the sages' svara, their common sense, and also their caring, their humanity. Chaim asked a question before, does about humanity affecting Pesach. Berkovitz is going to argue that you need to be humane. And you need to, and if Berkovitz was around, he would say you can't even be a posek if you're not involved with people with their lives. And he ends the section, the first section of the book, by referring to a famous Mishnah that illustrates the power the rabbis had. This Mishnah is cited by all the conservatives. Robert Gordas made a whole thing about this in an article in Judaism magazine. And it's very easy to say it's conservative Judaism, but you still need to explain the Mishnah. And Berkovitz sees this as a perfect example of his point. Here's the Mishnah. I forget where, let's see, I have the footnote in the back here. It's, get the Masechta. It's in, I think it's Chagiga, I'm not sure. I can't find it. Maybe one of you were, or no, it's in Croesus, I think. It happened once that the price for two such pigeons went up for a golden to a golden dinar. They're talking about the laws of sacrifices. You have to sacrifice a pigeon for this this occasion. Shimon Gamliel, head of Sanhedrin, then took an oath and said, "I shall not go to bed tonight until the price goes down to a silver dinar from two gold dinars to a silver dinar. From one gold dinar to a silver dinar." He went to the Beis Medrash and taught, "A woman, even if she gives birth five times, brings only one sacrifice. The rest are no obligation upon her." Pretty soon, the price for the pigeons came down to half a silver dinar. In other words, the price had gone up for a gold dinar, and then Rabbi Shimon Gamliel says, okay, from now on, even if she gives birth five times, she only has to bring one. One sacrifice. So it's better to have a silver dinar and sell five of them, sell five pigeons at a silver dinar than to sell one at a gold. At a price of a gold dinar. Here we have Rav Shimon Gamliel concerned about high prices and changing the halacha. Using the authority of the rabbis to say that until the price comes down, even though, according to halacha, that's what Berkovitz says, some of the commentators are aghast. How could Rav Shimon rule against the law? Rashi explains that even though Rabbi Shimon was treating a biblical commandment lightly, it was an occasion to act for the sake of the law. Eis lasos. Chazal had the authority to do things like that. Berkovitz isn't coming here to prove that. That's obvious. What he's coming to show is why they did things like that. Humanity, their caring. And this is going to come in later in the book. His argument that today's rabbis don't show that humanity and caring. He speaks of the great ethical sensitivity of the rabbis. How this leads them to interpret the law ethically. Eye for an eye. Why do the rabbis read eye for an eye, not literally, but read it figuratively? Well, the Rambam says that no one has ever took this literally. It's always been understood figuratively. Yet there is a day in the Gemara that reads it literally. But Berkovitz says they read it literally. And this is the way it's supposed to be read. Even if someone in the past read it, they read it figuratively. Even if someone in the past read it literally, that was a mistake. They read it figuratively, and that's the way it's supposed to be read, because the Torah is an ethical document. He doesn't see it in that it's some masorah or anything like that. He sees it as obvious that it has to be read figuratively, and the rabbis understood this. It's like perhaps you have some of these Pashtoni who try to show how it can't be literal. It has to be figurative. He's arguing because of the rabbis' ethical sense, they had to read it that way. Yeah. Yes, as I mentioned, Yossi, this is a famous Gordas, Robert Gordas, in his article. There was a symposium in Judaism magazine. It's a great symposium. Judaism still was publishing, and it was still a good journal. He publishes an article on the halachic process. What's more interesting than Gordas's essay are the responses to it from the Orthodox. You have Bleich, as only Bleich can do, totally denying everything that Gordas says and putting forth a vision of halacha that no one in history has ever agreed with. Not even the great rabbinic figures has ever viewed halacha like Bleich. You have to see what Rav Lichtenstein is seeing, the way he describes halacha, and he's describing it in opposition to Bleich. Bleich is this legal positivist, and it's just, his vision of Jewish law is just so incomprehensible, and he literally is the first one to ever describe it this way. And then you have people on the left, like Rachman, who basically agree with Gordas. Then you have people in the middle, Marvin Fox and Emanuel Jacobowitz, who agree with Gordas. Jacobowitz agrees with Gordas, but he says all these things took place when there was a Sanhedrin or a Beis Din HaGadol. We no longer have the authority. So he agrees with Gordas' description of Jewish law. However, he argues, but that we no longer have the authority for this. So to see how the Orthodox themselves understand Jewish law, great divergence of the Orthodox. And if you look at people like Chaim Soloveitchik and others, they're clearly in agreement with Gordas' understanding. Yaakov, what does Yaakov say? If you look in Volume 4 and Volume 1 of Bleich's Contemporary Halachic Problems, not only does he attack the people, I guess you'd say, to the left, he even attacks those to the right, the Haredim and Das Torah, the way they understand Halacha. But he speaks there about, in introduction to Volume 1 and Volume 4, how Jewish law, policy considerations don't affect Jewish law, everything is done according to the system. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Sri Diyesh, says explicitly differently, that there are times when you don't go by Kalei Halacha. Against the Kalei Halacha, precisely because of these Med-Halacha things. Rav Aviner has a long piece on this. Rav Gorin has a long piece. Now, Bleich might say that Aviner and Gorin don't count, but certainly the Sri Diyesh counts. You have to look at Rav Lichtenstein's essay, Orthodox Forum, about the ethical and ethical sensitivity in Halacha. People told me that at the Orthodox Forum, when he spoke, it was directed specifically against Bleich's understanding of how Jewish law operates. We can have a whole class on this, but I don't want to get into it now. But you see clearly in that essay there, he goes so far as to say that Rabbeinu Gershom's Takana, which we'll speak about in a few minutes, about, I think it was Rabbeinu Gershom's? No, about the Yavetz's Takana. I forget now which one. Someone will have to check it. He makes a comment that promiscuity was no different in the Sephardic world and in the Ashkenazic world. That relates to what Takanot that Gordas mentioned. And Gordas replies that Bleich is probably the first person in history to say that the promiscuity was the same in Ashkenaz as it was in Sephard. We have so many examples in Sephard of these men taking up with Bilagshim and all sorts of things, numerous tshuvot. No one ever speaks about this way in the Ashkenazic tshuvot. So he's an interesting case, a great halachic scholar, but one who I would say is not really attuned so much to the historical aspects, even from the Orthodox side. Just read with W.C. Hoffman, read with Hildesheimer, read with Herzog, and the rest. Their descriptions of Jewish law are very much in opposition to Rabbi Bleich. Berkowitz's Church's Tshuva, right there. You get, unfortunately, it's out of order, the Hebrew, but if you email me, I'll send you a nice PDF that puts it in order. There's another unpublished tshuva he has about wearing tzitzis out. Maybe I'll publish that as well. I haven't seen it yet. I haven't asked the family to send it. I don't think this is really an earth-shaking issue, should you weigh it out or not. But the church one was interesting. Let's go on. Capital punishment is read out of existence for the same reason, that it troubled their ethical sense. He brings many of examples that come into existence because Chazal tell us Kavod Abrios, or Darchei Shalom. Sages, Chazal compel men to give their wives divorces, even if from biblical law there's no source for it. Chazal rule that the testimony of one witness is enough to ensure the validity of a get, that is to say, it was written in Lashpa. And he concludes, page 22, all of the above rulings are somehow based on textual interpretation. But quite clearly, it's the halachic conscience that creates the interpretation. Get back to this in a minute. But he's saying that it's the halachic conscience, that they have a feeling of ethics. Taught from Torah, we'll see in a few minutes how he diverges from the conservative movement. But it's the halachic ethic which causes them to interpret the halacha in a certain way. Now, after discussing what the rabbis did with regard to women and marriage, he writes on page 45, that it's quite obvious that the rabbis were aware of the legally disadvantaged status of women, and they were disturbed by it and endeavored to correct the situation by innovative rulings of Takanot. Now, if I just stop there, said that Berkowitz is saying that women were disadvantaged, and that's why the spiritual mission is Takana, you'd have plenty of people who'd attack Berkowitz as a conservative rabbi, going to say women are disadvantaged. That's not the way traditional rabbanim speak. But in the next sentence, Berkovitz quotes the Tshuva of the Rosh, 44:1. And what does the Rosh say? I'll read it to you. He's quoting why Rabbeinu Gershom issued his takana. Kira Adar Parut, Samazalzalin, Bidnosi Stroll, Izrikas Get. He saw that the generation wasn't behaving properly. They would divorce a woman just by throwing the get to her against her will. Tikim Hashos, Kocha Isha, Kocha Ish. And therefore he made a takana to make the power of the man equal to the woman. Kemosha Isha in Omotzi El Ritzono, Kocha Isha in Omitgaresha El Ritzono. Because women were being treated improperly, they were disadvantaged, they could be divorced against their will, and people were doing that. And it bothered Rabbeinu Gershom. Say, why should it bother him? The Torah permits this. Women can get divorced against their will. Yet we've spoken so much about takanot. We've spoken about the Moroccan takanot and others. And Rabbeinu Gershom, according to the Rush, and Rabbeinu loves this source because it backs up everything he's saying, he saw that although something was technically permitted according to halacha, it violated the more essential ethics of Judaism. And when it became a real problem, a real issue, it was the responsibility of the rabbis then to come in with takanot, just like Chazal came in. Question then, why does the Torah permit it if it's going to lead to this unfair treatment of women, discrimination? I get to that in a minute. There's a reason. He continues, though, to say, after describing all these things the rabbis did to make the situation of women easier, he says, it's quite obvious that the rabbis were aware of the disadvantaged status of women. And not only were they aware, they were disturbed by it. And I just read you, I don't need to read the Rush again. Berkovitz admits that we can't make drushos. However, we can still follow the ethos of what the ancient rabbis were doing. And if you look at the Rishonim, we see that they were not afraid to make takanot. In their eyes, in the eyes of Rabbeinu Gershom and others, Jewish law is not frozen. We don't throw up our hands and say there's nothing we can do about it. There are things we can do about it. I just noticed that I didn't turn down the screen here, so let me turn it down. So I'm not reflecting so much. So what's the distinction? Why isn't this conservative Judaism? Berkovitz wrote against conservative Judaism. He was a strong believer that what he was doing was not just orthodoxy. I mean, what is the term orthodoxy? I don't even know if he liked the term orthodoxy, but this was Torah Judaism, traditional Torah Judaism. But why is this not conservative Judaism? He claims the real distinction is that conservative Judaism believes that halachic change has to come about because the tradition needs to be updated because of changing values in wider society. Wider society now has a different view, let's say, of homosexuality or about other things, and therefore we need to go back to our sources and update them because our sources reflect a more primitive development of Judaism, and now we've come to see because of the outside world certain values maybe we didn't know before. Law changes in the conservative movement because values change. Berkovitz, however, claims, and you might think he's being naive and probably not seeing what he's doing, but Berkovitz claims the law changes, but the values remain the same. The law changes precisely because the values don't change. He believes that there are biblical values, which in prior eras were not able to be realized. But now that we can, because we live in a more enlightened society, that's what we must do. But this isn't a reform. This is returning to the original intent of the Bible. It's not that we have now recognized new values from wider society, and therefore we're going to update Torah law. No, these are Torah values, but it was only in modern times, because of that changes in the general society, that we were able to realize these values. So it really is, at least in his mind, a real distinction between Orthodoxy and conservative Judaism. And he continues by discussing the concept of uprooting a commandment of the Torah, Eis Lassos, that rabbis have the authority sometimes to uproot a commandment. Chapter 4 is called Halacha in Exile. It's here that he discusses how Jewish law functions so differently in exile versus when Jews are in their own discussed this before with Rav Gorbert's saga. That was their issue also. Halacha, as it's been developed for the last 2,000 years, is developed for the Golos. The example I always give is Shabbos. Look in the Shulchan Aruch, look in the Poskim. There always is an assumption that there's a non-Jew around somewhere, that a guy can come help out if there's a problem. There's no halacha written. What do you do in a case like you're in a village in Eretz Yisrael today where there's literally no non-Jew? Shai Leibovich has thought, therefore, that all the Shabbos laws need to be rewritten. He had this whole radical perspective because they were written completely, originally, for a Golos society. But what do you do when you have a Jewish country? How do you run electricity? How do you... All these things, the laws as we have them on the books, are not adequate for a completely Jewish society where Jews controlling their own destiny. Obviously, Rav Goren and Rav Herzl, I think, go that far. But Berkovich recognizes the problem. And one of the problems, one of the symptoms, actually, is that of codification. Berkovich sees codification as a Golos phenomenon, which stifled the creativity of halacha. It was necessary to codify the law, because there was all sorts of so many problems, so you needed the Mishnah, and then later you needed Shulchan Aruch. Yet ideally, Berkovich says, Jewish law should not be codified. Chadal writes about this also incidentally. Had Jewish national existence continued to develop normally, where Jews were running the show, not when they were under the thumb of the Romans or anyone else, there never would have been codification. The period of the Tanaim would not have ended. There would be no conclusion to this period. Had the Beis Hamikdash not been destroyed, had Rome not come in, had the period of the Tanaim continued, Jewish law would have remained fluid Tanaim till now. Just like in the days of the Tanaim, it was fluid. Codification. One generation could uproot something a previous generation did. It was a continuing conversation. Jewish law would have continued as an oral tradition for each generation to decide what works for them. Drashot would have continued. Everything would have continued. Those of you who saw my Svarim blog post on Rav Cook and Sacrifices, you see there, he's imagining himself, he's not talking about other people, of what a future Sanhedrin will do, and he gives us the drashot that they can do. That's the sort of thing that would have continued. He says that the original Torah way is to turn to the judge in your own day. So what would it be if the Tanaitic system had continued? Year 2010, if we had a problem, we would turn to the great rabbi in our district. Just like in those days, you turned to Rabbi Shmuel or Rabbi Akiva, and he would determine what the law is for us without being bound by any earlier codification. He might be giving credence to a tradition or something else, but he's not bound by it. Jewish law would remain fluid. What's the real problem, therefore? Codification binds us to the authority and the understanding of an earlier generation. Therefore, Jewish law, he says, even in the state of Israel, is in exile today. Page 91. It is still the halacha of the shtetl, not that of the state. As yet, we have not become worthy of Torah Eretz Yisrael. We now have a state of Israel where Jews are living independently, and yet they still are following the halacha as codified in the shtetl. Say, well, Maran Yosef Karo was not living in the shtetl. He would reply, well, he was living in the shtetl because he was living as a subject of the Ottomans, and this wasn't independent, autonomous Jewish life. How then should Jewish law be functioning today, Berkovich says? It can no longer be defensive. It can no longer be about building fences around the community. It now needs to be offensive. It needs to deal with issues of social justice, economic problems, traffic laws, everything. Pollution. I mean, can you imagine if you had a posek today, the Haredi would never do it, maybe someone in the religious Zionist world, to write a tshuva about pollution, about environment. I think in the Tzohar group they're doing that. That's what Berkovich is speaking about. How does Jewish law function in a modern state? He tells us that because for so long Jews didn't need to deal with this, quote, the art and wisdom of such application dried up. Because of halacha's exile into literature and codification, halacha was no longer a living tradition. It's part of halacha, it was codification and literature. New barriers were erected that seemed insurmountable. The old principle of the acceptance of personal responsibility for halacha's decision, which demanded the Dayan rule according to what his eyes see, has received a new meaning. What's the new meaning? Berkovich says, quote, according to what he sees in some authority. Medallion today is bound by authoritative text. So it's not his eyes. It's what binds him is the previous authorities. Ravina and Ravashi are in Golas. That's Golas Halacha. The Talmud itself is Golas Halacha. It's the Mishnah codifies, and then the Talmud codifies, and then the Shulchan Aruch and others codify. He doesn't believe. I mean, what does Sofara mean? I can't recall him. He actually mentioned this, but his fundamental point is that ever since the Mishnah, we've been in the Galus Halacha. He believes that we can go back and recreate it. The Talmud and Eduyot, Mishnah Eduyot, speaks about rejected opinions still being mentioned, because in some future day you might need them. He wants to recreate the Tanaitic era. So when we say Ravina Ravashi or Sof Hara, they're Sof Hara for that framework. For Golas Judaism, not for modern day Judaism. But I will check for next week if he actually that's his whole point of his book, but if he actually deals with it. Remember, the first codification is the Mishnah. And that's not a good thing. It's a necessary thing for the time. But it's not the way Judaism is supposed to be. We're still supposed to be in that era, the Pharisaic era. He even speaks about the Karaitic inclination. He calls it a Karaitic inclination of Torah scholars to codify Halakha. By this he means, just like the Karaites treated the written law as not being able to be altered, rabbis today treat the codified law in the same way. And let me read you just one paragraph. The Karaite inclination of Torah scholars towards the codified phase of the Halakha is also responsible for their estrangement from the realities of the Jewish situation in the diaspora, and even more so in the state of Israel. He talks about exaggerated bondage to the written word. Then he says, the new reality of the state of Israel demands an understanding of what Halakha is about in its original classical sense. The Torah Shebaal Peh has to be freed from its Golos-imposed shackles. What was done to it happened, as we have seen, against the directives of the Torah itself. The Torah Shebaal Peh had to be written down because of the difficult circumstances Jews were in. But that's not the ideal. Ideally, it's not supposed to be written down. You're not supposed to have codification. Now, the greatest proof to his mind that Orthodox society has lost its way is the proliferation of yeshivas that have no interest in secular studies. He asks, where's the Toras Chaim? How come yeshiva students are not doctors and soldiers and everything else that a state needs to run? Torah scholars cannot live in a ghetto. Real Torah scholars need to be with the people, need to understand society. That, therefore, he sees that with all these yeshivas, it's galus transferred to the land of Israel. So what's the answer? The answer is to return to the oral law. How do we do this, though? How do we function this way? Can we over this halachot? He says that there are opinions cited in the Talmud that are rejected by the codifiers, but we now can resurrect. If the Rambam rejected it, the Shulchan Aruch, doesn't mean that we cannot return to the Talmud. A true halacha will be able to resurrect these opinions, because the Mishnah Eduyot tells us that these opinions are mentioned in the Mishnah, even though they were rejected, in case a future court needs to deal with them. And he says that in many cases you won't even need to do this, because halacha itself, even the Shulchan Aruch halacha, allows for revisions because of the changed circumstances of the Jewish state. The book also deals with issues of marriage and divorce. Rabbis are not willing to deal with situations, so they can remedies that they have. He also discusses the issue of Jewish unity. It states, page 107, quote, Halacha has to be stretched to its limits in order to further Jewish unity and better mutual understanding. He says we have to acknowledge that conservative and reform rabbis are God-fearing. Some of them, he says, not all of them. He says that there are conservative and reform rabbis who are God-fearing. They act l'shem shamayim. We believe they're wrong, but they are doing l'shem shamayim. They're not evil people. They are sinners. He says he can't even regard them as l'tei avon. They're not sinners l'tei avon, and they're certainly not l'hachis, but should be regarded, he says, as toim. People make mistakes. They don't know any better. And then this leads him to discuss conversion. which obviously separates Orthodoxy from the other denominations. Because Orthodoxy requires Kabbalah Samitzvos. Berkovitz asks, well, what does that mean, Kabbalah Samitzvos? That when you convert, you need to accept Torah and Mitzvos. He says it can't be accepting all the commandments of the Torah. We've dealt with this before with Ardoisi Hoffman and others, but Berkovitz is an original. He says it can't be acceptance of all the commandments because the potential convert is only told about some of the commandments. And how can he accept them if he doesn't know about them? It also doesn't mean some of the lighter. It says that we teach him some of the lighter and some of the weightier commandments. That's not what Kabbalah Samitzvos can mean also. Because the halacha is, the Rambam says, that if you don't tell the convert about this, it's also a valid conversion. And yet we also know that Kabbalah Samitzvos is required even b'diavad. So what is actually required? What mitzvos are required even b'diavad? And then if you don't know about them, it's an invalid conversion. What makes the conversion? He says acceptance of God, agreement to be circumcised, and immersion in the... That is what Chazal mean when they say Kabbalah Samitzvos. Those are the only things that are necessary and required, and without which a conversion is not valid. He doesn't say that this means that Reform and Conservative and Reform conversions are invalid. But he also doesn't say that they are valid. And what he seems to be saying is that, although he doesn't get into great detail, that the Conservative and Reform movement should not be involved in the conversion business. Let the Orthodox do it. And that the Orthodox can convert people who are going to live like non-Orthodox Jews, which is exactly what happened for so many years in the State of Israel. He says that this is not the best thing. He says this is our b'diavad. We're in an emergency situation. Conservative and Reform and Orthodoxy are reaching a place where they're not going to be able to be married, even intermarry with the Reform. If we don't accept their conversions, how are we going to be able to marry with them? Also the Conservatives. So it's an emergency situation. It's a shas ad chak. Therefore, he says, our b'diavad will be to perform conversions that are not the best conversions. They're not the conversions we like to perform, but technically they're valid conversions. And then he says to the Conservative and Reform rabbis, what is your b'diavad? How far are you willing to go to preserve Jewish unity by giving up your chachila, your ideal form of practice? He doesn't say what he's referring to. He simply says, what are you willing to give up in the sake of Jewish unity? We are willing to do conversions that are not the sort of conversions we would prefer to do. What are you willing to give up? And I think what he's doing here, I don't know why he doesn't say it explicitly, is he's asking the non-Orthodox rabbis not to insist on doing conversions. He had a similar case in the 1950s. The proposed Beis Din that Shaul Lieberman and Soloveitchik negotiated. It's often been described as a joint Beis Din, Orthodox and the Conservative. It was not a joint Beis Din. I wrote about this in Shaul Lieberman and the Orthodox. This was to be a Beis Din. No conservative people were to be on this Beis Din. This was to be a Beis Din recognized by the Rabbinical Assembly. In the name of Jewish unity, all conversions would be carried out, and all gittin, all these things would be carried out by this Beis Din. But it would be a Beis Din of only Orthodox figures that the conservatives were comfortable with, and the conservatives were going to make an amazing compromise in the name of Jewish unity, agree to allow all of their personal status issues to be carried by this Beis Din. And you can read Saul Edelman in the Orthodox, to read about why it never really got off the ground, what happened. The issue really was that Lieberman said that we couldn't control the conservative rabbis. We still would have conservative rabbis who wouldn't feel bound to us. Then what's the point of Beis Din then? But this was not a joint Beis Din. It was an Orthodox Beis Din that the conservatives... Really, the conservatives, we were giving up everything. That was the problem. If you read the internal conservative memos, which I did, for Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox, you see the problem was that the Orthodox were not giving up anything. There was no b'diavad from the Orthodox side. And the Orthodox were not even willing to put people like Boaz Cohen on the conversion. So it's understandable that the conservatives were not accepted. In this case, Berkovitz says, we are willing to lessen our normal requirements for conversion. That's our b'diavad. What's your b'diavad? Let me just read you one more minute. The last chapter of the book discusses how Jewish law can function in a democratic society. Today, we bring people to religion through persuasion, not pressure. And he says that that's the job of rabbis today, to interpret the Torah for the questioning Jew today. And therefore, the rabbi needs to know the zeitgeist. You can't send some guy out who just went to yeshiva and try to speak to intelligent Americans. They need to know the zeitgeist. They need to know the issues that are troubling intelligent people. And the book concludes as follows, and with this we'll end our discussion tonight and end our discussion of this book. Not only does the method of authority not work, it actually defeats the eternal validity of the Torah. The Torah is eternal because it has a word. It has a word for each generation. Every day the Torah should seem as new to you as if it had been given on that day, says the Midrash. One can find the word that has been waiting for this hour to be revealed only if one faces the challenge of each new situation in the history of the generations of Israel and attempts to deal with it in intellectual and ethical honesty. Alas, those who have authority to impose laws of the Torah do not care to understand the nature of the confrontation with the zeitgeist. They take the easy way out. They do not search for the word that was intended for this hour, for this generation. If they have the authority, they impose the word meant for yesterday. Thus, Smith's hearing the word that the eternal validity of the Torah was planning for today, for this generation, for this new hour in the history of the Jewish people. Next class, we are going to pick up. There still is something to do about Jewish law, because Berkovitz has another work, his last work, Jewish Women in Time and Torah, where he really gets to the women's issue. And deals with the question I raised. Well, if women are really put at a great disadvantage, why does the Torah do this? What do the rabbis to fix things? Shouldn't the Torah fix things? And from there, we're going to move on to his theology. I'll show you that. Deal with some faith after the Holocaust, which, unlike his halachic writings, remains quite influential. So I believe that probably next class we will finish with Eliezer Berkovitz, but there's still a good deal to do. So now if there's any questions or comments. Bill Gewirtz is typing. We've been doing so much about Gedolim, and I was asked to do some, really not Gedolim, but people who were important Orthodox figures and maybe today are not really remembered or were important in their day, not so much today. Berkovitz is one of those, Rachman, and there's some others. Finished with Berkovitz, we'll be back into Gedolim land with Chaim Moser Grzynski. Someone is typing. Okay. It says Bill's typing. I don't know. I will wait then. Don't know if anyone has any questions. I'll wait 2 more minutes to see if anyone. Next class, I'll also show you something very interesting from the Stipor about Das Torah. Stuff from Sfaradim about the Brisker Derech, something from Rav Chaim Hirschenson, an amazing piece from Rabbi Chiyo Yaakov Weinberg. Okay, Yisrael is typing. Yisrael, thank you, by the way, Yisrael, for sponsoring the class. I also want to show you, I didn't have time today, because we spent so much about Rabbi Yoshev's book. One of you asked me the source for my statement that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik never dressed in rabbinic garb. That was next class. I will give you, cite some of what appears in this work, Making of a Gadol, but also from the Rav's own mouth. I'll read to you what he says about Rav Chaim, his grandfather, in rabbinic garb. Yeah, but Bill, Berkovitz's point is that we can go back and the oral law can once again become the oral law. He doesn't feel bound by, he's not saying that we're going to do these decisions. He's saying, no, that like a group of rabbis or the leaders of the Jewish people, this is what they need to do. Is that they have the authority to, go back. Not talking about recreating Judaism, but if there's things that need to be done, and he speaks about certain problems, the women's issue is a big issue that he's concerned with, and he feels that there are certain halachic solutions that Chazal give us, but even though they've been rejected, today we have the authority, if we want to take the authority, we can once again create a system that we can revisit some of these issues. Well, no, I don't know if it's the ideal. It's certainly not the ideal for the average person, but it does become an ideal, and it becomes like a holy thing. Moshe Rabbeinu, he separated from his wife. The standard approach is, well, that's an exception. That was a peak circumstance. It doesn't apply to normal life, but you'll find people to say, no, that's certain very holy people, after they've had their children, they can go and live like Gandhi, live celibate lives. You have people who thought Yossi Voizov Novardik, I mean, he sort of lived an existence like that. My concern is that people see this, and then they think that this is, if I want to be a gadol, well, then this is something maybe to strive for. And I see this as a complete inversion of anything normal, and Berkovich would say of basic svara, that Jews are supposed to have involvement with their children. That is, we don't just have children to fulfill the mitzvah of Limud Torah. And what you're saying is, Bruce, I think you're being a little bit naive here. What does that mean, Das Torah? Obviously, even the greatest gedolim have issues. Everyone knows that some gedolim are quick-tempered. Others are more people-person. No one is saying that every gadol is perfect in every single respect. And that was the attack on Kamenetsky was not. They never denied this. It was that these issues should not be made public. So to take something that I think any normal person would see as not something normal, and not something positive. That's an issue. Rav Yoshev, that's not one of his strengths, and I feel very sad for his children and grandchildren. And he's not the only one. We can all talk about people we know maybe that are not parents and are not warm people, but that's not something we write about. And when you talk about someone, you want to talk about the positive things. I would think that people would see this as a weakness, so you can be a believer in Das Torah. Das Torah means that the sage speaks in a authoritatively from the Torah. That doesn't mean that every aspect of the sage's life, if the sage smokes cigarettes, that means you can say that's Das Torah, we're supposed to smoke cigarettes. The sage can also make a mistake. Even Das Torah people think that a sage can make a mistake, that he can sin, he can maybe be rude to someone and then have to apologize. No one thinks that the sage is infallible in the sense that never sins. They think that when he speaks on Torah issues, that their opinion is perhaps infallible or something we can't disagree with. But they're not going to say that every aspect of every Buddha's personality is perfect, because then what do you do for Shlomo Zalman Auerbach? He had a completely opposite personality. So I don't buy that. And if this is how he lived, it has to be the ideal. He can focus on the positive things, his learning, without saying that he never spoke to his children. He'd come and visit, and he had nothing to do with them. There's a story like this, which I don't believe. It's Rav Moshe Sternbach tells that the Chasam Sofer came to, Rav Akiva Eger came to visit the Chasam Sofer, his son-in-law. And whole Shabbos, he was so busy in talking and learning from the time he arrived until the time he left, he never once said hello to his daughter. The whole time he was there, he came, and he left, and never once said hello to his daughter. I don't believe that. The story is told, though. It tells you more about the people telling the story, though, that they think it's something. There's another story, I forget which gadol this is, that he was chavrusa with someone for 10 years, and he never learned the person's name, because all he was interested in is learning. Can you imagine a gadol b'Yisrael with simple, lacking such basic decency that he wouldn't even ask the person he's... I don't believe these stories are true. However, people invent them because they somehow see this as... that's my sense of it. Lech's approach to halacha is that there's no influence of ethics, of morality. It's all text-based. And these things don't come into play. And you have numerous examples of Rishonim and Acharonim that say otherwise, that they have a... I think it's a Tashbait that says that the reason Rashi rules in favor in many cases was because he had daughters. That's the sort of thing that, and even not talking that way, just that, as I said, Rothstein's essay about the effect of values on halacha, look at the introductions to volume 1 and 4, he puts forth a positivist perspective which totally denies the these elements whatsoever. That's a theory in the law, positivism, but and it might be good legal theory, but historically it's very bad history. Because history has never worked that way. So Bleich might make a very good judge, but he's a terrible, or a very good posek for that matter, but he's a terrible legal historian. It's no accident that every legal historian, or every historian of halacha who's ever lived, has come to different conclusions than he has. And, authorities just as great as him in the Orthodox world, such as Rav Lichtenstein and Rav Soloveitchik. Take a look at Rav Soloveitchik's famous letter on the chaplaincy. He tells you that before he decides what halacha is, he was led in a certain direction by his intuitive feeling, and he knew what the conclusion had to be. It's Bleich who's a Das Yachid on this. Oh, okay. Sorry. Bruce, you're right. If you're writing a biography, that's the honest fact. But this is not a biography. This is a hagiography. This book is not completely honest. It doesn't tell you about certain things. It's telling you what you need to know to admire Rav Elyashiv and to give you his life. I am just shocked that they think that these descriptions, and not just me, everyone I've spoken to, were all shocked that they think that this falls into hagiography. Because the average person reading this is going to come away with negative views of Rav Elyashiv, and that's exactly what you don't want. In a hagiography, you're right. As a true biography, you would want to discuss these things. But these sorts of books are not true biographies, precisely because they're hagiographies, and that's precisely why they don't really include these things. Art Scroll. I've noticed, by the way, in the Haredi Israeli works, you have things that you'll never find in the American works in English. That's my only point. You're right. They do view them as some sort of an ideal. It's almost like the priesthood for monks are in Catholicism. That no one is saying that everyone needs to be a priest. It's not for everyone, and not everyone could do that. But those who do choose to become priests, there's an element of admiration for them. So I think the same with Rav Elyashiv, that this isn't the way most people should live. But if you're such a person who's so involved with Torah, that his whole life is Torah, so much so that he is removed from any relationships with the family and literally doesn't speak to them, that's a sign of greatness. It's not something you and I can do, but it's something special and it should be admired. And maybe this is just a reflection of my modern sentiments. I don't see this as something to be admired. 200 years ago, I probably would say this is to be admired. I don't know, but it just can't be healthy. What can I say? And not only can it be healthy, this isn't the way our other Gedolim lived. But our Gedolim, do they live like this? And the book tells you, the book says that don't think that he doesn't like people, or that it's just that he's very shy and it's difficult for him around people. So they tell you that he has these issues, that he's very much an introvert, and the only place he can find happiness is with the book. Okay, so they tell us that. They need to tell us that because his whole life has been this way. But to many, many introverts, they can't talk to other people, but they're very loving to their family. Show us that there's no love whatsoever in the family, that already is, to put that in a hagiography, it tells us a great deal about the society. You're right. More than that, I've written on the Svarim blog. I gave some examples. When you tell a story, for example, about a gadol, who when he's sitting he goes to someone's house for Shabbos lunch, and this is told of admiration, he's there with a sefer, and he keeps the sefer under the table. The whole time he's at the dinner, he's learning. In our world, we'd say this is very rude, and yet that is shown as something great. Or when you tell a story that the sniper at his wedding was learning. At the wedding, he was learning. We would see this as... Rav Soloveitchik would say this is not normal. But you learn a lot from a society in what they put up as models of admiration. That by the same token, you have stories of Shlomo Zalman Auerbach. The Dafka would tell people, like in a car, if they took out a sefer, it's impolite. You know, someone's driving you, you have to talk to the person. You can't just sit there and take out a sefer and start learning. So you have the opposite model also put forth. But we have the hagiographies, the more of the reclusive intellectual type who learning trumps all human relationships. So I guess we have two Haredi models, let's tell you. Perhaps, but Rav Eliashiv was never in a yeshiva. That's what makes it interesting. He never studies in a yeshiva. He is really the old-fashioned approach before they have yeshivas where people would study in the Beis Medrash. It talks of, for 10, 15 years, he would study before he was really discovered, just sit in the Beis Medrash, and he's continued for the rest of his life with the door locked, studying by himself. No chavrusas, really. For almost all of his life, he studied by himself. And, you know, if you're in yeshiva, you're involved with people, he's studying by himself. So, I don't know, if you say yeshiva, and yeshiva, you still have to have human relationships. You're right, yeshiva has put a stress on Torah study above all else. Especially now in yeshivas, you don't need to eat with people. It used to be when people at Essen Tug, you'd go every day, you'd eat at someone else's house. You had to interact with alabatim, with normal people. Now you go to the yeshiva, you literally never need to leave. They serve you their meals, and the whole society around the yeshiva is the yeshiva world. You no longer need to be with alabatim. So that is true, Ira, but Rav Eliashiv's case is even more so, because he doesn't even have the interaction of yeshiva. He was always a loner. I don't know why. Kitav published this. They published the other ones. This is going to be reprinted. We now have this volume published by the Shalem Center, Horan's place, Essential Writings of Berkovitz, and they're going to reprint to Not in Heaven. I'm assuming the reason publishers don't reprint this is because they don't think there's a market. Family wants it to be reprinted. Does it say something about orthodoxy, that it's moved so much that no people are buying it? But Not in Heaven is going to be reprinted. Yeah, so thank you, Dov. Well, you're right. How could you deny what was the major point of his life for so many years? He was a Dayan. He was a great Dayan. Everyone knew he was a great Dayan, and it's only because of Rav Goren becoming chief rabbi, as we've mentioned, that he left being a Dayan. Rav Goren's election of chief rabbi turned out to be the worst thing for the religious Zionist world, because that's what Rav Eliashiv decided. He could no longer serve as a Dayan under Rav Goren, and had Rav Goren never been elected, had someone else been elected, Rav Unter Shal Yisraeli, Rav Eliashiv would have remained the rest of his life a Dayan, and that's what would have been his life. He never would have become the leader of the Haredi world because he was a member of the Rabbanut. Once he leaves the Dayanus, and he still to this day lives on his pension from the government, he then develops a following, he becomes the Gadol of the Haredi world, he's coming. And then, so then how does it affect us? Why is it a bad day for the religious Zionist world? Because unlike Rav Shach and the Stipler, who said that it was forbidden for their followers to become Dayanim for the government and be involved in the Rabbanut, Rav Eliashiv has a different approach. He comes from that world, so he believes in conquering it. And he himself has become more right-wing, but he believes in taking it over. So his followers, Rabbi Sherman and the rest of them, instead of shunning the rabbinate, like it used to be the case, so the Mizrahi people could control it, they believe in conquering it. And therefore they took over the Dayanim, the Batei Din, the Chief Rabbinitz, he puts in this crown Rabbi Metzger, they take over the various Batei Din. And now that's why we have the conversion controversies, because you have Rav Eliashiv's followers in it. But they have to speak about it, unless you want to be completely dishonest. That's who he was a postsake for 1746 until 1970. You can't just cut out 25 years of his life. They don't have a picture of him with Rav Goren. There are pictures of that. I don't think they have a picture in here. They don't have a picture of him standing here for Atikva. But they have the pictures, so I don't know if that's being honest or just, I mean, how else could you describe him? They do feel that they're being honest, but you know, there's a lot of things you can. He also was involved in terrible machlokas, and you don't need to describe all these machlokas. You don't need to tell the whole truth. You need to tell the truth, not the whole truth. Why to stress? You've seen the book, I see. Why stress no relationships with his family? not just once, on a few occasions, that he has no involvement with them, doesn't have any knowledge of their life or anything like that. Why? It's not just being honest. I think it's trying to show, they see this as some, almost like the ideal of the monk. But this is not for us, but this is something holy, something special, where you move beyond human relationships. It's almost like the Buddha. If you know the famous story of the Buddha, when he finally leaves his palace, and he goes with his charioteer, his horseman, the guy who was with him, and this guy who's been his loyal horseman for all these years thinks he's going to go with them, and the Buddha says, now we must part ways. And it's like if two birds come on a branch, and then they part ways, or clouds part ways. It's time for us to go our separate ways. Here, he's comparing the deepest human relationships of friendship and say it's like when two birds fly off in a different direction. And Buddhists look up upon this as some amazing thing. It's almost like Rav Elyashiv is being portrayed as someone who's so connected to Torah, he's moved beyond human relationships. And to actually have love and affection and all these things with your children, that is somehow removal from this pure Platonic Torah scholar who has no connections in this world other than Torah. Just like the Rav, though, says halachic man. He describes halachic man. He says this is like economic man. It's not a real person. It's only an ideal type. They are creating an ideal type and actually trying to make it a real person and saying Rav Elyashiv is this ideal type in the flesh. That's the only way I can make sense of it. Anyone else who's read the book, people in the Haredi world, the American type Haredi world, they too find this to be shocking. So, I don't know. A few more questions before we end. It's not Hashkafa. It's not Rav. I would say it's not Rav Yashiv's Hashkafa. Rav Yashiv is a person who is very much of an introvert and has difficulty with human relationships. We've all known this. The book now tells us that he has difficulty with familial relationships even. And there are plenty of examples of, especially men, who have difficulty with children, are distant, and he's not someone who's just going to sit watch TV. So he obviously has difficulty. He's the distant father. And he finds his salvation in the books. We have cases like that. Do you have psychologists for that? That's an issue. And the hagiographer is describing this. So my problem, though, Ira, is that it's described and it's turned into an ideal almost. This is something to be... I think this is something to feel very sad about. When you look at the relationship that Rav Chaim Soloveitchik had with his sons, that Rav Moshe Feinstein had with his sons, you see wonderful relationships of fathers and sons, close relationships, and of daughters also, of Aaron Cutler with his daughter. You don't see this here. And I happen to think it's very sad. It's tragic, I think. I'm just shocked. I'm happy they wrote it in the sense that I learned more about Rav Elyashiv. It helps me understand him. But I'm shocked that this would ever appear in a hagiography. You know, Bruce, maybe you're right. I find that hard to believe, though, and I don't think so. Maybe some think that. I don't know. Okay, could be. Certainly the person who wrote the book feels that. I just don't think that's the mainstream Haredi view. I don't even think in Eretz Yisrael the simple people may. Could be I'm way off on this. Could be that this is like a dominant view. But I don't know. They do talk about the Vilna Gaon. They do talk about the Vilna, but no one's writing. I don't think they would write it. I didn't think they would. I always said that they wouldn't write these things about the Vilna Gaon today because it would reflect poorly. I now have to eat my words because in this book, they're writing about the Vilna Gaon of our day in the very same terms. And yet he's the Gadol that succeeded Roshlomo Zalman Auerbach. And Roshlomo Zalman Auerbach, look at the hagiographies. One of the hagiographies is titled HaTorah HaMesamechet, the Torah that brings joy. And it's all about the pictures of Rav Shlomo Zalman with his smiling and how much he loved everyone from this person and how he brought such joy to everyone and his tzidkus. And here you have the exact opposite, where the Torah life is not lived in connection with others, in fraternity, community. It's lived as a recluse, as a hermit. It's lived like a Ben Azai type of existence, where you just live by yourself. You don't need to marry. You're married to the Torah. To say there that it would be unheard of for my father to ever go on a tiyul with my mother, to have any small talk with her, I would like to think that our Gadolim have small talk, that they bond with their wives. This, to me, just, what can I say? I'm shocked. Because I read many hagiographies, and none of them portray them like this. The only one you get like this is the Uvdos Van Hagos Beis Brisk. When they describe the Brisker Rav, you get this sort of thing. I would call these horror stories. But every other hagiography, they always stress the humanity and the tzidkus and the love and the personal connection. Yet that Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky would take the garbage out because he didn't want his wife to have to do it. Or they always stress these things. This book goes back, you might say, it's a pure Lithuanian perspective of Torah only. Human relationships are no... How can I say? You learned something new. Okay. It must reflect the shift away from family. That's going to be very sad now. If all of a sudden we're raising children and raising people for marriage, that their learning is supposed to be more important than taking care of their family and having familiar relationships. Talk about driving kids off the derech. You can be sure that's going to do it. It goes against, though, basic human psychology. Human psychology is to love your children, involve with them. If people need to be trained that this is not normal, deal with a sick society. No. Yes, we spoke about that before, Bruce. I gave an example of that. It does strike us as horrible, so much so that Sokol, in his article, Sokol and Singer argued that Rav Soloveitchik was actually mocking his family. We already said that can't be the case. Rav Soloveitchik idolized his family. But he does bring these examples in. You're absolutely right. And these are the sorts of examples that we read them and we see them as unbelievable. Hasidic hagiographies on the will never have stories like that because Hasidic hagiographies are the anti-Talmudist. It's all about love of people, love of family. You know where the Hasidic hagiographies go crazy? Not like this. You have Hasidic hagiographies that portray the Rebbes as worried. Are they really tzaddikim because they love their children more than they love other Jews? That is, they go to the other extreme. They portray how the Rebbe loved every Jew just like his own family, which I can't believe either. But just like that can't be healthy. How can you love a typical person more than your family? That's the other extreme. But you know something? If I had to pick an extreme, I'd rather have an extreme that's all about love, about loving your fellow man. And if they want to portray an ideal that you have to reach the state where you love everyone just like you love your family, that's got to be a better thing than to say that you want to have no connection to your family, just like you have no connection to everyone else. So the Hasidim are the anti-snagid when it comes to this. Remember that story in Halachic Man? They asked the Rav about this, by the way. I think Rav Lutzing mentioned this. How his father rebukes the Chabad Chassid, who starts crying before Tkiyas HaShofar. And what could be wrong with this? And if I'm not mistaken, the Rav said, you're right. I don't understand why my father was so upset with the Chabad Chassid. That's a story that's being very Lichtenstein. Because we have to rebuke the Chabad Chassid for getting emotional over the blowing the shofar because it's just another mitzvah. But when you say his love for his daughter in here, it talks about how he has no conversations with the daughters whatsoever. I'm not saying he didn't love his children, what type of relationship is this? To tell us, the reader, that and quote the daughters, that they had literally no conversations with their father ever throughout the entire week. Is that healthy for a child to grow up never conversing with the father? That's told in the book. You're right. Coldness is not an uncommon trait, but this is coldness squared 1,000 times. That's why this book is so controversial. Because never before never before has there been a biography of a Godot soul where they actually do this and actually portray in this way, and I think for a good reason, because I don't think Gedolim have been this way. Gedolim are complicated people. Obviously, Litvox are colder than many Litvox than we think of the Worm Chassidim, but not cold like this. This I find very troubling. Let's leave it at that. He said, that'll be so. I'm not speaking. I would never bring this up if I knew. I've heard stories, unbelievable stories, similar to this. Cases where people told me, people from the inside told me these stories, but I wouldn't repeat them because I thought they were Lashon Hara. But here you have these stories. So, saying our salvation. The Revelia prisoner was, descriptions of him are really in contrast to Reb Chaim as a very loving person, in the sense that Chaim was also loving, but Reb Chaim was shown to also be very rules-oriented. Revelia prisoner, his daughter, was a special person because of the house she came from. That's why that story would have made so much sense if it was Reb Chaim, not so much sense with Revelia prisoner. I would have made sense with Reb Chaim. Not because Reb Chaim was a cold person. Reb Chaim was a very warm person. But Reb Chaim's entire life was guided by halacha. Reb Chaim was an emotional person. The Rav speaks about it. He would see the sunset and the incredible emotions, all sorts of emotions. But everything was controlled by the halacha. So within the halacha, the emotions were allowed to function. It wasn't like a spark, a lack of emotion. You're right. I would say this is someone who has, like some people have, difficulty relating emotionally. And I think it's sad. And I'm upset, actually, that some people would think that this is an ideal. Yeah, you're right, William. You're exactly right. And that's the Brisker of also. You have these amazing stories that, from our perspective, are really crazy, but they're all about the halacha. How everything needs to be controlled by the halacha. The Briskers were always very emotional. And the love, the Briskers, the way they loved their family, don't mess with one of their family. Family was very important. And what Reb Chaim and what Reb Moshe Soloveitchik wouldn't do for their children, or Reb Moshe Soloveitchik did for Reb Soloveitchik to try to get in positions, what Reb Chaim Soloveitchik did to try to get Reb Moshe Soloveitchik positions, I mean, and the learning, just look at how Reb Moshe describes his learning with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, and how Reb Chaim understood his connection, his learning with his sons. It was an emotional tie. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik said at the Hesped for Rav that ever since Rabbi Akiva Eiger of Shlomo Eiger, no two Gedolim souls have been so united as Rav Moshe Soloveitchik and Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik. So there was a great love and a deep connection. It's very different, very interesting. Okay, we'll have to stop here. If any of you want more comments or things you want me to pick up on this, I just mentioned it because one of you asked me if I could speak about Hashakdan. And therefore, I give my opinions. I did not at all mean to be in any disrespectful to one of the great Torah sages, but a book was put out describing him in a certain way, and I felt it's right for me to say that I wasn't impressed in a good way. I felt very sad seeing that one of the greatest gedolim we have is so far removed from human interactions, because I think that's basic to what makes a leader. Not someone who's hidden behind walls with handlers who can full access to him. I just don't think that's the traditional way. And there's been a lot written about this book. So my two cents. Okay, God willing, we will all pick up next week. Again, welcome all of you to the new semester. Thank you very much for tonight.